an Osho talk. Walking in Zen, sitting in Zen.
Talks on Zen stories, number 11.
The first question. What is the meaning of existence? Meaning is a human invention. There is no meaning in existence itself. It is beyond meaning. It is not meaningless either, because a thing can be meaningless only if it is possible for it to have meaning. Meaning and meaninglessness are two sides of the same coin. As far as existence is concerned, meaning is totally irrelevant. So is meaninglessness. For centuries, man has been imposing meaning on existence, because it needs guts to live joyously without meaning. It needs real intelligence to live in ecstasy without any meaning at all. The crowds don't have that much intelligence. They need some excuse. Howsoever false the excuse is, it does not matter. Even a false excuse is good. For them to live far. But they are absolutely in need of a meaning. It is man's need that imposes meaning on existence. More immature a man is, more is his needfulness for meaning. As he becomes mature, the need becomes less. When man really comes of age, there is no need for meaning at all. One simply lives for no other reason. One lives for life's sake. Then existence is not a means to something else. It is beautiful as it is. It is not fulfilling any purpose. In fact, because it is not fulfilling any purpose, that's why it is so beautiful, so utterly beautiful. It has no utility. It is not full of commodities. It is full of poetry. What meaning a poetry has? What purpose? What meaning a rose flower has? What purpose? What is the meaning of a night full of stars? And what is the meaning of love? What is the meaning of all that you are surrounded with. There is no meaning in it. And if you are in need of meaning, then you will project. Then existence becomes just a screen, and you project your meaning on it. For centuries, humanity has done that. And because of it, now we are suffering tremendously. Now man has become more mature. He is not so childish as he was before. And he can see that all those projections are nothing but projections. All the meanings are collapsing. And now, a great chaos is created by the collapsing meanings which we have believed in for thousands of years. A great meaninglessness is felt all over the world. All modern thinkers, from Soren Kierkegaard to Martin Heidegger, are all concerned with only one single question. And that question is the question of meaning. And all are convinced that there is no meaning in life. But then why live? Naturally, inevitably, the second question arises. If there is no meaning, then why live? Then why not commit suicide? Marcel used to say that the only significant philosophical question is suicide. Why go on living when there is no meaning? It is sheer cowardice to live when there is no meaning. And Marcel has some relevance in the context of the whole human history of thought, philosophy, religion. All the values are disappearing. And man wants anything to cling to. Because all gods have failed, man is inventing new gods. It is difficult now to believe in the Christian Trinity, God the Father, Christ the Son, and the Holy Ghost. It is almost impossible for any contemporary person to believe in this nonsense. But when this belief disappears, a vacuum is felt. You start missing something. You cannot continue the old belief. And you cannot tolerate the emptiness that is left behind. Then something has to be substituted. Anything will do. Then there are many substitutes. Communists have provided their own unholy trinity. Karl Marx, Friedrich Engels, and V.I. Lenin. You see the point. The Christian trinity was also all male. The communist trinity is also all male. There was no woman in the Christian trinity. There is no woman in the communist trinity. It is a replica. Exactly the same. Many theologians have tried to bring Christ's mother Mary from the back door in the Trinity, but they have all failed. Centuries, again and again, the effort has been done, but it has not succeeded. And the same has happened with communist Trinity. Stalin tried to become one of the parts, but the magic number of three cannot be disturbed. So while he was alive, he forced himself. He became one. The Trinity was no more a Trinity. It started consisting of four persons. The moment he died, the fourth was dropped. Even his grave was removed from the close proximity of Lenin's grave. They could not tolerate even his dead body there. Mao Zedong tried in China to enter into the Trinity. The day he died, he was removed. When old gods fail, a great vacuum is felt. It is not accidental that in this century, Adolf Hitler, Joseph Stalin, Mao Zedong, and people like these became so powerful. Their power was not their own. Their power consisted in the vacuum that has been left in the human heart because of the old values have disappeared. And man has lived for so long with a certain meaning in life that he has become incapable to live without meaning. Either commit suicide or invent a new meaning. My own approach is totally different. There is no need to commit suicide. That is sheer stupidity. There is no need to invent any new meaning. That is falling back. That is regressive. That is again becoming immature. It is a great opportunity that is knocking on your doors. As a whole, the humanity has come to a certain point of growth from where a quantum leap is possible. Man can start living without any meaning and still beautifully. Still with tremendous joy. That was one of the greatest contributions of Gautama the Buddha. He has not been understood yet, but now his time has come. He came a little too early, 25 centuries before his time. But he speaks like a contemporary. Jesus speaks the old language, the language which children can understand. And so is the case with many others, with Moses, with Muhammad. But Buddha speaks the language of maturity. He says there is no meaning in life. And there is no need of any meaning. Drop the hankering. And don't try to fill this vacuum. This vacuum is good. It is healthy. Abide in this emptiness. Rejoice in this emptiness. Don't go on stuffing with unnecessary things. It has a purity. This emptiness, which is being felt now by many more people than it was ever felt before. Only once in a while a man like Buddha had felt that all ideals are false, imaginary, inventions, toys to play with, to keep children engaged so they don't create mischief. Temples, churches, mosques, gurudwaras, these are places to keep children engaged so that they don't create any trouble. So they don't create any mischief. These are sedatives, so that you go on sleeping. These are sleeping pills, tranquilizers, which help you to remain non-violent, to remain non-destructive, to remain peacefully sleepy. Otherwise there is danger. You cannot be trusted. You cannot be allowed freedom. These are your bondages. These are prisons which you think are temples. They are not temples. And the gods you worship are not gods. They are just playthings to keep you occupied. To keep you afraid. To keep you frightened, to keep you greedy. They don't transform you. Their whole function is to serve the status quo, to serve the wasted interests of the society. Buddha says the inner emptiness is so beautiful, don't stuff it with junk. Leave it as it is. And that's what meditation is all about. That's what Zen is. It means living out of emptiness, asking nothing from life, living moment to moment. For no other reason. Just enjoying being alive. It is more than you can ask for. What more meaning do you need? Is not breathing enough? Is not this chirping of the birds enough? Is not the green and the red and the gold of the trees enough? Is not this vast existence with all its splendor enough? You want some meaning? Yoga says, the moon rises above the river. On the bank, the wind plays softly in the pines. All night long, pure and calm. What is the meaning of that serenity? Look on the Buddha's precepts of nature. Winter and autumn mists, dew, clouds, spring mists are the true robe which covers our body. What is the meaning of that serenity? There is no meaning at all. But let me remind you again, I am not saying life is meaningless. You are so much obsessed with meaning that the moment I say there is no meaning, immediately you conclude the opposite. Immediately something inside you says, so there is no meaning in life means life is meaningless. I am not saying life is meaningless. I am simply saying meaning is absolutely irrelevant. Life is more than meaning, far more. Machines have meaning, flowers don't have meaning. Meaning means utility. A car has meaning because it serves a certain purpose. A railway train has meaning. An aeroplane has meaning. They are utilitarian. But what is the meaning of a beautiful sunset? And the clouds turning all the colors of the rainbow? What is the meaning of it? What is the meaning of a rainbow? Can't you see things just as they are? Can't you just be a mirror without projecting any meaning? If you can be just a mirror, there is no meaning and no meaninglessness. You rise above both. You rise above duality. And then there is great serenity. The moon rises above the river. On the bank, the wind plays softly in the pines. All night long, pure and calm. What is the meaning of that serenity? And realize it this very moment. Don't think about it. If you think, you have already gone astray. A single thought much, and you are as far away from the truth as you can be. Just see it. I am not preaching you a certain ideology. I am not imparting any information. I am not concerned with any creed. I am simply saying my vision. Just for the moment, look through my eyes. For the moment, feel through my heart. Let your heart beats be rhythmic with my heart beats. That is satsang. That is communion with the Master. For a moment, breathe with me. For a moment, disappear. For a moment, don't think. For a moment, forget that you are. Then only you will be able to understand. Seeing is understanding. It is not a question of thinking. And once you are freed from meaning and meaninglessness, you are freed from all prisons of beliefs, ideologies, scriptures, Hindu, Mohammedan, Christian, Jaina. You are suddenly out of all the prisons. For the first time you are under the sky. When you are utterly empty, just as the sky is outside you, infinite, so is there a sky within you, as infinite as the outer one. And when you are not asking for any meaning, both these skies meet, merge into oneness. That experience is God. God is not a person. That experience is God. The second question. It is impossible to find jokes about Asis. They are so lukewarm, so boring, so nice. They never offend anyone. There is no character to poke fun at. Have you noticed? In a certain way, you are right. They are lukewarm. And they are nice. And certainly lukewarm people are boring. To be interesting, you need a certain intensity. Nice people are boring. You can have nice people only for a little while. You cannot live with nice people long. They will kill you by boredom. They don't have any spice in them. They don't have any salt. They don't taste at all. They are tasteless. In that sense, you are right. But that is enough to create many jokes. In fact, that is a perfectly beautiful jumping board. An Englishman decided that he wanted to become Irish. After much research, he discovered that the only way to become truly Irish was to have half his brain removed. He managed to find a surgeon who would operate. But during the operation, the doctor made a dreadful mistake and removed his entire brain. When the man woke up, the doctor said, "I am very sorry. I have made a mistake. Instead of taking half your brain, I removed it all." To which the patient replied, "No worries, Kabir." He had become an Australian. The young Australian got married. "Look, son," said his father, "when you are alone tonight with your bride, take her clothes off. Take your clothes off. Put your hand on her belly and say, 'I love you, darling.'" "Yes, Pa," said the young man. When the feast was over, he took his eager bride to the room, dimmed the lights, stripped her of all clothes, sat naked by her side, laid his hand on her stomach and said, "I love you, darling." "Ah, lower, lower," groaned the girl, patting his hand. Says the Aussie, "I love you. I love you." The third question: please talk about surrender and obedience. On the surface, they appear alike, but they are polar opposites. One who is surrendered need not be obedient. Obedience is needed only if there is no surrender. You will be a little puzzled. Because you have been told and taught and conditioned that obedience and surrender are synonymous. Obedience means you are not surrendered, you are forced to be obedient. There is ego inside you which you are repressing. Hence, obedience is needed. In army, obedience is needed. Obedience has to be enforced. Those who are obedient have to be rewarded, and those who are not obedient are to be punished. slowly, slowly, everybody turns into obedience. This is just a conditioned reflex. This is what they do with rats in psychological labs. This is how they train the rats. And the psychologists don't think there is any difference between rats and men. And about 99.9% people, they are right. There is not much difference. Only once in a while, a Socrates, a Zarathustra, a Lao Tzu, a Buddha may not fit with their idea. But they never come across such people. And even if they come across a Buddha, they will not be able to persuade Buddha to come to their lab so that they can experiment. They can catch hold of rats. They can catch hold of monkeys. They can purchase ordinary human beings who are ready to be experimented upon if they are paid well. Anything can be taught to you. For example, now, Skinner and company proposes that there is no need to tell people that smoking is bad or dangerous to your health. There is no need to tell them that it is a sin, immoral. All that is needed is give them few electric shocks. Whenever the urge to smoke arises in them, the moment they take out a cigarette from the package, give them an electric shock. So a shiver goes through their spine. Soon, just the idea of smoking a cigarette will be enough. There will be no need to give them electric shocks, and they will get the shock. The cigarette will drop from their hands. Slowly, slowly, even the urge will disappear. They say that we can condition a man in whatsoever way you want. There is no need to follow these old rotten tracks, very long, of moral preaching and teaching and is still to no effect. Nobody is afraid of them. Who is afraid of hell now? Maybe in the beginning it was like an electric shock, but now people have become accustomed. They have become adjusted to the shock. Now the hell is not a shock at all. If somebody says to you that don't smoke cigarettes, you will go to hell. There is no shock to you. But 5,000 years before, it was enough to give you a shock. The idea was the same. Make people frightened. Modern technology makes it easier. They have found shortcuts. And they think that there is no difference between rats and men. Because rats learn the same way. Punish them, and they will stop doing a certain thing. Reward them, and they will start doing it again and again. That is the way of creating obedience. That's how it is created in the army. That's how it is created in the scouts. That's how it is created in the police. That's how it is imposed on the whole society. Surrender is a totally different phenomenon. Surrender means you are in deep love and a great trust has arisen in you. Such trust that there is no question of repressing yourself. You are sannyasins here. I have nothing to reward you. In fact, you have to go through all kinds of difficulties here. You come from far better, far advanced countries. You have beautiful homes. You have lived more comfortably with all the luxuries, with all the gadgets that science has made available. You would have never thought that you will have to suffer this nightmare in Pune. This heat, mosquitoes, rats, cockroaches. From the West, many things have disappeared. But here, you have to live in a very primitive condition. You have to live almost 2,000 years back. I am not offering you any reward. I am not promising you any paradise either. Because I say, drop the very idea of the future. Live in the moment. And to live in the moment and in Pune, it is arduous. It is difficult. Then why you are here? I don't promise you anything at all. You are here just for the sheer love. You have fallen in love with me. It is not a question of obedience. You are not drilled to be obedient. You are not conditioned in any way to be obedient. Just the other day, Prem Zareen had asked a question. You say that I give freedom to my sannyasins. Is this applicable to sannyas too? She means that is she free to drop sannyas? Yes, Zareen. I give you total freedom. Total means total, without any exception. If you have taken sannyas out of love, then there is no question of dropping it. If sannyas has really happened, then how can you drop it? It is not something that you have put upon yourself. It is something that has grown in you. Just as you cannot drop your heart, how can you drop your sannyas? If it is your heart, you cannot drop it. From my side, yes, absolutely yes, I give you total freedom. There is no question about it. You are free to drop sannyas. It was your freedom to be a sannyasin. It is your freedom not to be a sannyasin. But the whole question hangs on something very deep. If sannyas has happened out of a love affair, then it is impossible to drop it. Even though the freedom is available. But if you have taken sannyas for some other ulterior motives, then, of course, it can be dropped. And then it is better to drop it. Because it has not happened in the first place. Why carry an unnecessary burden? In short, if sannyas has happened, you cannot drop it. If you can drop it, it had not happened in the very first place. And then you must drop it. Not only I give you freedom to drop it, I will help you to drop it. Because I am not in favor that you should be burdened by anything that is not growing in you. You are already too much burdened, Zareen. 1001 things have been imposed upon you. I will be the last person to make your life more of a burden. Sannyas is not like an arranged marriage. It is a love affair. In a love affair, there is no question of divorce. Because we are never married. So the question of divorce does not arise at all. And if love is authentic, if love is really there, it is forever. There is no end to it. It begins, but it never ends. Hence, I can give you total freedom. Because I am not imposing any obedience on you. Where obedience is imposed, freedom cannot be given. Because if you give freedom, then obedience will disappear. Here, trust is happening, surrender is happening, love is happening. From your side, trust, surrender, from my side, freedom. From the disciple's side, surrender, and from the master's side, freedom. Where this freedom and surrender meet, there is communion, there is satsanga. It is not a question of obedience. When I say something to you and you do it out of your love. Not because it is an order and you have to do it. There is no question of forcing yourself to do it. In obedience, you are doing it even against yourself. Even in spite of yourself. In surrender, the ego is no more there to resist. The ego is absent. When I move my hand, what is happening? Is the hand obeying me? Or is the hand totally surrendered to me? The hand is totally surrendered to me. There is no question of obeying me. The hand exists no more as a separate entity. Zareen in sannyas, the disciple disappears, becomes part of the master. He becomes his hands, his eyes. Ramakrishna was dying. He had a cancer of the throat. And in the last days, it became impossible for him even to drink water. Vivekananda said to him, Bhagwan, can't you ask God to do just a little favor? If you simply say to God, it is bound to happen, that at least you should be allowed to eat and drink, it is becoming too much a suffering for your body, and not only for your body, for us all. We cannot eat because we know you cannot eat. It has become impossible for us to drink because we know you cannot drink. How can we drink? So if you don't care about yourself, okay, but think of us. We are also suffering. Just for our sake, close your eyes and say to God that do just a small favor. Ramakrishna closed his eyes, opened, started laughing, and he said, you fool, if I listen to your advices, God laughs at me. I asked him. That was his way. He has not asked. There is nobody to ask. That is his way. He will not hurt Vivekananda. He closed his eyes. He may have even moved his lips to show Vivekananda that he is praying to God. And then he opened his eyes and he said, God laughed at me. And he said, Ramakrishna, you are listening to these fools? you follow their advice. They are your disciples or you are their disciple? Who is who? You have eaten from this throat so many years. Can't you eat and drink from the throats of your disciples now? And Ramakrishna said, Vivekananda, his argument appeals to me. So you stop torturing yourself, suffering, because now I have lost my throat. I have to depend on your throats. You eat as much as you can, a little more than usual, because a part has to go to me. Drink a little more than usual, because there will be my share too. So eat, drink and rejoice. Because God has said, Ramakrishna, you can eat from your disciples' bodies. Why depend on this body? And this body is gone and rotten. There is a certain invisible unity, an organic unity between the master and the disciple. Zarin, one is free, absolutely free with me. If one wants to drop sannyas, one should not think twice. One should simply drop it and forget all about it. If it can be dropped, it should be dropped. If it cannot be dropped, only then it is worth. I give you total freedom. But if surrender is there, there is not going to be any difference. In fact, total freedom will make your surrender easier. When there is somebody to impose something upon you, a natural resistance arises. It is very natural. If I am here to impose something upon you and to make you obedient, then you will resist. Then it is just human. But I am not imposing anything. That's the beauty of this commune. That's something unique that is not happening anywhere in the world. Everywhere, obedience is being imposed. In subtle ways, or not so subtle ways even. Either directly or indirectly. Do this, don't do that. People are being treated like slaves with no respect. I respect you. I love you far more than you can ever love me. I respect you far more than you can ever respect me. Because whatsoever you will do will be limited. And whatsoever I can do will be unlimited. Your so-called gurus and your pseudo-masters all depend on your obedience. They enforce upon you. And you are willing For the simple reason that when somebody is there to impose something upon you, he becomes a father figure to you. He takes the responsibility. You need not feel responsible for yourself. You need to depend on somebody, and you have to pay the price for that. Then they go on ordering you as if you are small children. A little boy went to the school for the first time, and the teacher asked, "What is your name?" He said, "Johnny Don't." The teacher said, "I have never heard such a name before. Johnny Don't." He said, "That's my name. Whatsoever I do, my mother shouts, 'Johnny Don't.' My father shouts, 'Johnny Don't.' Wherever I go, somebody or else immediately says, 'Johnny Don't.' So I assume that this is my name, this must be my name." And because from the very beginning your father, your mother, your parents, your teachers, your priests, they are all teaching you, do this, don't do that. They are all creating a certain obedience in you. You become addicted with obedience. It is a drug. So when you come to me, you would like, people go on asking me. I never answer their questions. They go on asking me, "Give us detailed instructions. What should we do and what we should not? We want clear instructions from you." I give you clarity, not clear instructions. Because my instructions may be right today, tomorrow they may not be right. My instructions may be a hindrance for your growth tomorrow. Because nobody knows about tomorrow. It is unpredictable. So I give you clarity, so that you can find your own way of life today and tomorrow and day after tomorrow. Wherever you are, if you have clarity, you will be able to find your way. I give you total freedom. I share my light with you. I share my joy with you. I share my freedom with you. I don't want to become in any way a father figure to you. Always remember me only as a friend. You ask me, please talk about surrender and obedience. Surrender happens through love, trust, egolessness. Surrender means surrendering the ego. Obedience is a cultivation of the ego, of pruning the ego here and there, bringing it into a certain shape, into a certain form, so that it can adjust with the society, so that it can adjust with the already established order of things. Obedience is in the service of the past. Surrender is not in the service of anybody else. Surrender is simply becoming free of your ego. And the moment you are free of the ego, your life starts growing wings. Ego is heavy. It is like a rock hanging around your neck. It goes on keeping you tethered to the earth. It gravitates towards the earth. Once the ego is dropped, suddenly you start rising upwards. Your life becomes a tremendous upward movement. You are uplifted. Surrender makes you weightless, allows you to go against gravitation. Another law of life starts functioning, the law of grace. There are two laws. One law, science knows, the law of gravitation, that everything falls downwards. Another law that religion knows, that everything falls upwards. If you are ready to drop the ego. It is said about a Hasid mystic, Jhushya, who could have been a Zen master, who could have been a Sufi. In fact, the enlightened people don't belong to any tradition. They are born somewhere. One has to be born somewhere. You cannot be born everywhere. So it was just a coincidence that he was born a Jew in a Hasid tradition. But he was a strange Hasid. Hasids are strange, but he was the strangest. He was very unpredictable. I at least come here and tell you a joke so that you can laugh. He was far more strange. He will simply come here and start laughing. Not even a joke. Hasids love beautiful jokes and stories. So once he was asked, Jhushya, what kind of Hasid you are? At least say some jokes, some stories. You simply come and start laughing. He said, I am saving all my jokes for God. Because I don't have anything else. I don't know how to pray. I don't know any scriptures. I am saving some beautiful jokes for him. And when Jhushya dies, you will see. And actually it happened when he died. There was great thunder. And people said, he has reached. And God is laughing. Jhushya was staying in a house, in a disciple's house. The family was a little worried about the man because his ways were strange. He can do anything. In the middle of the night, he may start laughing. He may wake up the neighbors. He may create scene. So they put him in the basement and locked the doors for the night at least, so they can be at rest and the neighbors can be at rest. In the middle of the night, suddenly they heard laughter from the terrace. They could not believe. The rest, Jhusya was rolling on the roof and laughing. They said, Jhusya, what is the matter? He said, that's what I am laughing. I was sleeping in the basement. Suddenly I started rising upwards. But he was simply making it clear that there is another law which does not believe in locks and does not believe in falling downwards. His actual words are, suddenly I found myself falling upwards. That is the law of grace. Surrender. And suddenly you are in a totally different law. Your gestalt changes. You start falling upwards. And there is great laughter in you. And the whole existence laughs with you. There is no question of obedience here. Obedience is an ugly word. Fourth question. Please tell a British lady a British lady joke for those of us learning to laugh at ourselves. Halfway through her world cruise, the English lady attended the ship's ball, became slightly intoxicated by champagne, and ended up sleeping with a good-looking Italian steward. But the very next day, when the steward approached her on the quarter deck, the English lady cut him dead. "Hey, Contessa Mia," said the steward, "don't you remember the good times we had last night?" The English lady looked up briefly from her game of bridge. "In the circles in which I move, young man," she said crisply, "sleeping with someone does not constitute an introduction." Fifth question. I am always worried what others are thinking about me. What should I do? There is no need to do anything, because I know about others. They are constantly worried what you are thinking about them. The seventh question, is it true that the meek shall inherit the earth? Yes, because the rest of us will escape to the stars. The eighth question, who are the most noisy while making love? Two skeletons on a tin roof. Ninth question. Gurdjieff had a beautiful water pipe and did not hate cigarettes either. All his life, Balshim had a clay pipe in his mouth, does smoking really have to drop? And if so, how come the only temple in the ashram is the smoking temple? My whole effort here is to transform the mundane into the sacred. It is an alchemical school. We change base metals into gold. That's why the smoking place is called a temple. That is the only temple we have. I am not against smoking. I don't smoke myself. Because now in the air there is so much smoke. One need not bother carrying a clay pipe or a water pipe in one's hands. Just ordinary air is enough. It is so polluted. In fact, ecologists say that it is a wonder how man is surviving. Because just 50 years before, scientists used to think that if air becomes so polluted as it has become today, in New York, in Bombay, in Calcutta, in London, then people will die. But man has tremendous capacity to adjust to any situation. Where so many cars are moving and so much smoke is there and trains are moving and planes are moving and factories, there is no need to carry a private pipe anymore. You simply breathe air, and you are smoking. I am a lazy person. Gurdjieff was not a lazy person. That's why he used to carry his beautiful water pipe. And in Balsam's days, the air was not so polluted. If you wanted some smoke to go in your lungs, you had to make private arrangements. Now it is universal. And I am not against it. Because at the most, it can kill you a little earlier. So what? If you don't live 80 years and only live 78, does it matter? In fact, the world is so overcrowded that everybody will be happy that you are gone. Do you know how much we celebrate when somebody goes? We don't celebrate anything like that. A little space is created. You can smoke as much as you want. health is merely the slowest possible rate at which one can die. You can go a little quicker. And in these days of speed, when everything is going faster and faster, this is old-fashioned. Just to go on dying in a healthy way. Go on lingering and lingering. Health is the longest route. But finally you have to reach to the grave. And when shortcuts are available, the wise people always choose the shortcuts. So don't be worried. In the new commune we are going to make many temples. And we are really going to make them beautiful temples. Because when somebody is in such a hurry, we should make every arrangement that we can. We should give him all help that we can. We will make beautiful temples. Well decorated, comfortable, luxurious, so you can rest and smoke to your heart's content. Living in an unconscious way makes no difference whether you live 70, 80, 90, 100. It does not matter. Living consciously even for a single moment is enough. My whole effort here is to help you to become conscious, even if for a single moment in your whole life you become absolutely conscious, you will not be coming back. You are well gone. Then you are really gone into the universal source. That is one of the names of Buddha, Sugata. Sugata means well gone, one who has really gone and will not be coming back. And if you are conscious, then it is up to you to decide whether you would like to live a little longer or a little less. Nobody else should decide it for you. And how anybody else can decide? Morarji Desai's government was trying to impose prohibition on the whole of the country. And 80% of his cabinet ministers were drunkards. And he himself was worse than all of them. He was drinking his own urine. I would rather prefer wine. If one has to choose between wine and urine, wine seems to be far more aesthetic. And it is far more vegetarian too. Urine seems to be animal food. And just think of the whole passage it comes. The long journey it takes. Now the second step after that is not very far. When Indira became Prime Minister, I was wondering why she is not moving into the Prime Minister's house. She took 2 months to move. I inquired, what is the matter? And I was informed that she is changing all the tiles of the bathrooms, because who knows what he was doing inside the bathroom. And the whole house was being almost renovated. Everything was to be cleaned. All utensils had to be removed. Who knows what he was doing? And in his bathrooms, all that was found was different kinds of enemas. Two months it took to change the whole house. It must have been stinking. I am not against smoking or even against drinking. Once in a while, it is really beautiful to drink. There is no need to be so superhuman. Be human. That's what I love more in Jesus than I love in Mahavira or Buddha. Buddha and Mahavira are too abstract, almost inhuman. Jesus is very human. He drinks and he eats and he loves feasting. And late in the night they eat and drink and they gossip. The new commune is not going to be a commune of ascetics. Ascetics are pathological people. My sannyasins are not ascetics. My sannyasins love life. Of course, when you live consciously, it is up to you to decide if you want to drink a little beer once in a while. There is nothing wrong in it. But the decision comes through your own awareness. If you don't want to drink, there is no need. In fact, I don't drink for the simple reason because just soda bottle gives me enough intoxication. So there is no need to mix any whiskey. Why waste whiskey? I keep it for others. Whenever Paritosh celebrates his birthday, I send him a bottle of whiskey or brandy. Whenever somebody brings brandy, I keep it that Paritosh will need soon. His birthday will be coming. For me, just the soda is enough. The last question. Please, just one joke more about the blowjob phenomenon. Muktananda. Sorry, Paramhansa Muktananda. I mean you son of a bitch. Are you mad or something? Why are you obsessed with this great phenomenon? But if you want, it is okay. George Stearman was a legendary businessman, a great success in America. He began as an IBM salesman of typewriters, and within 10 years his sales and executive leadership was so outstanding that he became sales director for all office products and small computers for a 9-state area from Texas to California. When Xerox expanded into computers, he was lured away to their corporate headquarters outside New York, and within 10 years of record achievement, he was national sales director for Xerox. With a position on the executive committee, all he lacked before the presidency was a seat on the board of directors. He had a beautiful wife and 3 children in college and a house in Darien, Connecticut, that looked like Mount Vernon. Then on Christmas Eve, when the other chief executives had all gone off to the Bahamas, Florida, or Aspen for the holidays, George went into the office to get his year-end paycheck with the expected large bonus. When he opened his paycheck, instead of a big bonus, he had a check for severance pay. He was fired. George felt totally distraught, but made it home after a few martinis. When he opened the door, there was a note on the Christmas tree that said, "George, I have had it. I want a divorce. The children and I are gone." Blindly he went back to the city, got himself thoroughly drunk, took the elevator to the top of the Empire State Building, and was about to jump over when he felt a small tug on his spent leg. He looked back. There stood Santa Claus. Jar said, "Santa, get lost. Get away. I have lost everything. My job is on the rocks, and my wife and children have left me." Santa replied, "Wait, George, I will give you 2 wishes if you give me 1. "Okay," said George, "I want my wife and kids." "No problem," said Santa. "In 2 days they will be back." "Great," exclaimed George. "What about my job?" "Well," said Santa, "there has been a power play. You just wait until New Year and you will be the director of Xerox." "Wow," said George, "that's great. And what can I do for you?" "Well," said Santa, unzipping his fly, "my wish is for you to give me a blowjob." "What?" screamed George. "I am 45 years old. And I have never done a thing like that." Well, said Santa, a deal is a deal. After George had finished, Santa zipped up his fly. Looking up, George saw tears streaming down Santa's face. What is wrong? He asked. Santa looked down at George and said, it is rather touching to find a 40-year-old man still believing in Santa Claus. Enough for today.